Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
In the past weeks and months, we've seen that some climate activists have turned to more radical methods of protesting, like gluing themselves to paintings or deflating tires of SUVs. Are these forms of protest still legitimate? I spoke to the Swedish climate activist and thinker Andreas Malm, who published several books about the topic, one with the title How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire. There is a controversy going on about Malm in another regard. His invitation to the Climate Action Day in Vienna has been withdrawn due to comments he made about the state of Israel. At the time of the recording of this interview, we had no knowledge of these proceedings, and our interview focused exclusively on the question of the climate crisis and climate policies. And my first question was, a lot of people agree that the climate crisis is urgent, and yet there always seems to be something more urgent, be it the pandemic or the energy crisis. Why is that?
Yeah, isn't it frustrating? I mean, it feels like every wave of climate activism and discussion about the issue is overtopped by a wave of a different kind. So we had a wave in 2007 that was overtopped by the financial crash. And we had a wave in 2019 that was obviously overtopped by the pandemic. And now it's the war in Ukraine and the energy crisis that seem to be the overriding concerns. And I mean, all of these issues could be dealt with in a progressive way where you combine action on these fronts with climate mitigation, but that hasn't happened, unfortunately.
And the energy crisis, in theory, would be a good motivation for states to implement more radical climate policies. But at least the German government is now talking more about oil, gas, nuclear plants than it's talking about renewable energies. Even though the Green Party holds the Ministry for Economy and Climate Protection, what's your take on that? Why are we seeing a retreat in a way that governments are falling back to non-progressive policies?
Yeah, why is that? Well, first of all, we really should stress what you just said, that just as the pandemic, this war was early on at least seen as an opportunity for the long overdue transition away from fossil fuels to renewables. But instead, what you see is the opposite, just like you outlined, where countries like Germany or the UK are doubling down on fossil fuels. So in Germany, you see this building spree of fossil gas terminals and pipelines. In the UK, you have the lifting of the ban on fracking and the expansion of drilling rights in the British sector of the North Sea. And this is now the general response across the board in Europe and elsewhere, that we're dealing with this energy crisis by increasing the supply of fossil fuels. And this just at the moment where we're like on the threshold of 1.5 degrees of global warming. It's just a few tenths of centigrades left until we're there. And we're seeing climate disasters on a daily basis playing out right now, obviously worst in Pakistan, where that country is completely devastated by the monster monsoon the other month. And yet countries are encouraging further investment in fossil fuel installations, exactly what we cannot have any more of. And just as you said, the rollout of renewable energy has stalled and virtually come to an end precisely at the moment when we need it most and when we need to deal with the climate crisis and the energy crisis by massive public investment in wind farms and solar farms to replace fossil fuels. But we're seeing exactly the opposite on the ground. And why is that? Well, one reason is, of course, the deeply entrenched power of fossil fuel companies, not the least in countries such as the US, but that holds in many other places as well. And perversely, these companies are now swimming in larger profits than, well, at least a decade or more. You know, the profit bonanza that they're experiencing is just unprecedented. And the largest oil and gas company, Saudi Aramco, recently posted what's believed to be the single largest quarterly profit in the whole history of capitalism. And BP, ExxonMobil, Shell, all of these companies have so much money thanks to the high oil and gas prices that they are reinvesting them in even more exploration of oil and gas fields, new pipelines, new terminals, new platforms, exactly the kind of installations that we cannot have. So the situation is basically out of control.
You say that you observe a radicalization of the other side that you also call the enemy. Who is the enemy exactly, and why are they radicalizing?
Well, I mean, the central enemy, if we want to talk in those terms, I take to be fossil capital, and most particularly the companies that profit from the production of fossil fuels. They have the most aggressive interest in perpetuating business as usual because their entire business model has to come to an end. So ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Saudi Aramco, those companies that profit from extracting fossil fuels, they cannot exist as such companies in a transition away from fossil fuels. And they know it. And that's why they are more deeply invested in perpetuating business as usual than virtually any other lines of business. And they are at the source of the problem, and I consider them to be the main enemy, the main obstacle to the transition away from fossil fuels. And this is pretty broadly accepted in the scientific literature that that's the case. But if you're talking about a political enemy, well, then you might say that the far right is the main enemy. And if you're talking about a radicalization there, perhaps you can see it in some respect. The far right, which has no climate politics.
But one could also argue that the fossil fuel companies, they could change their business model in the future. They could transition to other energies. I want to stay again with this notion of who's the enemy here, because it might be that the notion is misleading since we're all entangled in the same capitalist system. So wouldn't the answer be to abolish capitalism?
Yeah, that might be necessary in the end, sure. But let me just clarify here that these big oil and gas companies, they could hypothetically become renewable energy companies, but they're not. And the reason is that the profits that they gain from oil and gas are infinitely larger than any profits that are on offer in wind and solar. So these companies, they are pouring virtually all their investments still into oil and gas, regardless of all the rhetoric about net zero and being green and being part of the solution that you hear from them these days. But at the end of the day, what they're interested in is maximizing profits. And how do they do that? Well, they do that clearly by continuing to expand oil and gas. That's where their big profits come from. And the enemy here is, I mean, it's not a coterie of persons. It's not a cable. It's not a group of individuals. It's a system in the sense that these companies have to produce as much profits as possible. And they do it by digging up fossil fuels, precisely the activity that has to come to an end. So that activity must be terminated. Does that mean that you also have to abolish capitalism as a whole? Well, I would say that we don't know, because capitalism as a mode of production once existed in history without fossil fuels. And I don't think it's logically impossible to imagine capitalism going on existing in some form or another after fossil fuels. It's not by definition inconceivable. But, you know, everything we know about the problem of climate change indicates that a particular part of the capitalist system, or the capitalist class, if you will, must be abolished, namely the part that accumulates capital through the production of fossil fuels. That has to just go out of business. And that is a very big political task to undertake to achieve something like that. And if we were to achieve it, we would probably set in motion very deep processes of social transformation that might potentially take us beyond the capitalist status quo as we know it now. And where we end up in such a process, we don't know. Perhaps in some kind of post-capitalist society where, for instance, the social public control over energy production is so extensive that you approach something that isn't any longer recognizable as capitalism. But I wouldn't say that we know that any meaningful mitigation of the climate crisis implies axiomatically, first of all, the abolition of capitalism as a whole.
You're a Marxist, and why would you say that the climate crisis essentially is a question of class and we have to tackle that first?
Well, it's a question of class insofar as like I said, the main engine of this problem is the segment of the capitalist class that lives on, that profits from, that derives its entire wealth and power from the production of fossil fuels. And this is the engine that, you know, keeps this problem accelerating. Obviously, you could also go back in history and look at how class struggles between labor and capital have created this whole mess. I did some work of that kind in an early book that I wrote about the original transition into fossil fuels in the 19th century and how that was connected to class struggles in Britain. And the recent surge in emissions in China in particular is deeply linked or rooted in the worldwide struggle between labor and capital, where the reason that so much industrial production has ended up in China and is powered by coal is that the workers on offer in China from the turn of the millennium have been cheap and disciplined, and more so than in countries like Germany or the US, at least until recently. So if you want to understand why China has become the world's largest source of CO2 emissions, you need to understand what's been happening in the struggle between labor and capital and why so much production has been relocated to China. So the ongoing daily struggle between the classes is a key determinant of where emissions end up geographically and how they increase.
So if I understand correctly, you want to solve the problem that we have right now within the existing capitalist system. And you argue that speed is of the utmost importance given the dramatic consequences of climate change that we see now. If we look at the political sphere, are democracies in a capitalist system capable to implement radical climate protection policies, given that the democratic processes that we see tend to be rather slow and focused on short-term outcomes?
Yeah, no, but let me just begin by clarifying my position. I didn't say that I think that this problem has to be solved within capitalism. But my argument is that the immediate measures that need to be undertaken confront certain capitalist class interests. And if these demands are fulfilled, you might set in motion a process that could potentially lead us beyond capitalism. But no social change starts with the abolition of capitalism. This is a classical Leninist politics, if you like. I mean, what the Bolsheviks did in the Russian Revolution was that they implemented key basic demands, land, bread, and peace. And these demands came into collision with the interests of the dominant classes, and to get these demands fulfilled, you had to remove these classes from power, and thereby you set in motion a process that went beyond the capitalist status quo. And something similar would be needed today. How does this relate to democracy? Well, to begin with, if you look at the energy sector, what you need is an extension of democracy. And what we're having right now in a lot of our countries like Germany, the UK, the US, Canada, is formal democracies, but outside of their purview, you have private companies operating without any kind of democratic oversight or control. And these private companies are still bent on taking up as much fossil fuels out of the ground and, you know, handing them over to various fireplaces where they are combusted. And a basic measure to solve this problem is to take these private companies under public control and force them to terminate their oil and gas or coal production, in the case of countries like Germany or Australia. And this means a socialization, a nationalization of these businesses, which would extend democracy to the sphere of energy production, so that you no longer have private entities operating and setting the world on fire just because it's in their pecuniary interest to do so. The logic of climate action is that rich people can no longer have the right to burn this planet. And if measures of that kind were implemented, it would mean a deepening and broadening of democracy. Now, are our current formerly democratic states capable of doing this? Well, that's another question. I mean, it doesn't seem very likely, for instance, that President Macron in France would take over Total, the single largest private company headquartered in that country, which is one of the leading climate crime syndicates in the world right now, for instance, building the East Africa crude oil pipeline, which would be the world's longest heated pipeline. I mean, that's an obvious candidate for socialization. Take over that company, sequester it, put it under public control, and force it to wind down its oil and gas production to zero within a few years. No, it's not very likely that Macron is going to do that. It would require a completely different balance of forces in French society for something like that to happen. And this is where the mobilization of social forces outside of parliamentary assemblies comes into play. And the power crystallized in fossil fuel companies have to be countered with a kind of popular power from below and from outside of parliaments for a shift to be possible.
So what you're describing is something that you call the ecological Leninism. And I would like to understand how a top-down policy, as you just described, for the sake of climate protection, would be compatible with democracy, where the majority has to agree that these measures are necessary? Or would you say that the climate energy crisis is so intense right now that it justifies authoritarian action?
No, it doesn't justify restrictions in democracy. Exactly to the contrary. What it justifies is an extension of democracy. And if you look at polls, the consistent result is that majorities around the world are asking for climate action. And the gap seems to be between the popular desire for climate action and what governments are actually doing. So I don't think that the structure here is that governments want to do a lot while majorities don't want to see climate action. It's more the other way around. So governments need to be more aligned with popular opinions on these matters. But we should remember that democracy and a degree of coercion are not necessarily incompatible. So if you have a situation where a majority favors the nationalization of fossil fuel companies, then the democratic solution would be to enact such a nationalization. And that's, of course, a coercive, forcible takeover of companies, of private energy companies like RWE in Germany or Shell, now based in the UK or something like that. Take these companies over and force them to do something else and desist from what they're doing now, namely ruining this planet. And some degree of coercion is inevitable if you're going to deal with the climate crisis. And again, I think this is pretty clear in the science that you have to imagine a situation where states tell certain actors that you cannot any longer continue doing what you're doing. You know, this is the essence of climate mitigation, that you actually force people to stop certain activities.
Yeah, but
that in itself doesn't clash with democracy, I think.
But I don't know if I agree, actually, because we've seen the opposite happening. As soon as people started to introduce the idea, for example, of a veggie day in Germany or a speed limit, some people were against it. And there was a tendency that people said, when we're told what we're allowed to consume, what car we're allowed to drive, how fast we're allowed to drive, what we can eat or not eat, we're boycotting the whole thing. So how would you deal with this?
True. Yes, meat is an extremely ticklish and sensitive topic. And the car as well, in extremely car-dependent countries like Germany. I mean, and it's the same in Sweden. Yeah, of course, I'm not saying that there is no popular, emotional or cultural investment in fossil fuels and the machines that they power, or in meat for that matter. And here you have to acknowledge a real political problem in that majorities have to be swayed and persuaded to break these bonds of loyalty with these things that we can no longer consume. That's entirely correct. And this is a big political struggle. This is the political struggle that we have to wage against, for instance, the far right, which I think in both Germany and Sweden is the most aggressive promoter and defender of the car for various reasons. But I also think that recent experiences from the pandemic, not the least, suggest that people are actually prepared to swallow quite a bit of changes to their lives if there is a reasonable case being made that we're facing an extreme emergency and we have to change the ways we're living. And we should note that nowhere in climate politics is there a suggestion for extreme measures of the kind of, you know, locking up entire populations in their homes for months on end or other kinds of intrusions and interferences in people's private lives of the kind we saw in the pandemic. So you wouldn't need pretty authoritarian measures of that kind of the climate transition. It wouldn't serve any purposes. But yes, some deeply ingrained habits will have to be changed, and there will be resistance against such change, as there always is. I do think that the climate action that we need to begin with is one that can easily gain a lot of popular support. And that's not, I mean, the first task isn't necessarily to turn everyone to a vegetarian diet, although I'd be massively in favor of that. But the first things to do is to, like I said, take over fossil fuel companies, wind them down, and roll out massive public investments in wind and solar to replace these fossil fuels. And if we're going to deal with emissions in the consumption sector, what we have to go after first are luxury emissions. So the completely superfluous, unnecessary emissions that have a bizarrely outsized role in total emissions that are made by rich and ultra-rich people. I'm thinking of things like, you know, having a lot of SUVs and private jets and private helicopters and super yachts and mansions. This kind of lifestyle that produces completely mind-boggling amounts of emissions. You know, the richest 1% have emitted more than twice as much as the poorest half of humanity over the past decades. And these emissions we can go after, and I don't think that a majority would oppose that. I think a majority would perhaps even revel in the sight of these emissions being taken down.
So you're basically saying we need to convince people, we need the popular support, but you're also writing in your book that we need more radical action on the ground. You think that we have to turn the crisis into a crisis of the ones who drive it. And I'm wondering how exactly would that work, this radical action on the ground? Because you're thinking in your book about militant acts of civil disobedience. Your book is called How to Blow Up a Pipeline, basically. So what exactly do you want people to do on the ground? And how would that get more popular support for the cause of climate action?
Yeah, good question. Well, I think we're seeing on the ground steps in this direction, where the climate movement in the global north and our countries is now experimenting with forms of sabotage and property destruction. We've seen this in Germany with Ende Gelände endorsing sabotage as a tactic and engaging in quite a bit of sabotage during the recent climate camp in Hamburg in the second week of August.
And do you agree with this?
Yeah, of course. Of course, wholeheartedly.
Why?
Well, because we cannot have a situation where new fossil fuel installations are built. This is totally patent and manifest and obvious. And it's well known that if we're going to have any chance of staying below the 1.5 degree threshold, and it will be soon the same for 2 degrees, we cannot build new gas pipelines or open new coal-fired power plants or coal mines. And still, this is happening. So we, of course, as the climate movement, need to realize that we must step up. What we've done so far isn't enough, because we're still seeing this completely unsustainable and unacceptable expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. So what do? Well, we go into these sites and try to sabotage the construction that is going on there, and also thereby send a clear signal to the public and to governments that this expansion isn't a natural force. It's not like a diurnal cycle. It's not like the movements of the sun and the moon. It's not like, you know, a mountain range that's just there. This is an infrastructure that is being built by humans and that can therefore also be stopped by humans, perhaps other humans who go in and disrupt the construction. And one of the central problems of the climate crisis is this perception of this infrastructure and its expansion as forces beyond our control, as something that just happens, that we cannot do anything about. And that perception induces paralysis and despair in people, because people think that this is our fate. We can't do anything about it. And the point of going into these sites and sabotaging the construction that is happening there is to pierce, to debunk this perception and say, no, this is something that we can put a stop to. And you're seeing similar things in the climate movement in the UK, where Just Stop Oil is experimenting with sabotage of petrol stations and other kinds of oil infrastructure. You see it with a very rapid spread of the tire extinguishers deflating SUV tires around the world now. Yeah.
So many things to say. There is many reasons why people would not agree with this point. They would say, like, it's morally not justifiable, these actions. And practically, it doesn't persuade people, as we see. It rather divides people instead of unites them, especially these tire extinguishers that deflate tires. You do damage to the property of individuals instead of companies or instead of a structure, or you're not attacking policies, you're attacking individuals. So morally and practically, would you say this makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. What's the moral objection to it?
The moral objection
would be,
would be these acts are not justifiable because it's not civil disobedience. You're not attacking a state, you're not attacking a policy, but you're attacking individuals for their choice that they made to buy this car, for example.
Okay. Yeah. So first of all, no one is attacking individuals. Individuals are human beings with bodies. There has been zero attack on any individual. What has happened here is that you have people deflating tires. Tires are not individuals. Tires sit on cars. Tires are dead, inanimate objects. So they don't have any moral integrity, or they don't suffer anything. But you're right. The point of this kind of action is to establish a disincentive, a deterrence, if you like, to signal to people that if you continue driving around with SUVs and if you continue buying SUVs, you face the risk of waking up in the morning with tires deflated, so the car disabled. And this is a totally morally justified act, because but these emissions are luxury emissions that kill people.
But how is it practical? Because what we see is that these people who are being attacked, or their cars are being attacked, they won't say, oh, now I understand, I didn't have the information before about the climate impact of my vehicle. They are rather going to say, now I'm going to drive it even more, and these acts are not going to give you the support that you want.
I don't think they're saying we're going to drive them more, because you've already seen advices to car consumers in mainstream outlets such as The Telegraph telling people that perhaps you shouldn't buy an SUV because you run the risk of deflation. Now, the point here isn't to persuade SUV owners to come over on our side. The point is to inflict a kind of material inconvenience on that sort of unjustifiable consumption. So it is not convenient to have SUVs whose completely unnecessary emissions, again, kill people. If there's any harm to individuals that is perpetrated here, it's by these luxury emissions. And we really should keep in mind that when people die in a country like Pakistan today, they die from emissions that are being made primarily in rich countries and that have been made over the past two centuries. That is the morally unjustifiable act. And if governments cannot bring themselves to stop this act and cannot even go after the most meaningless emissions that have no basis in human needs, because people don't drive SUVs because they actually need to. The reason for people consuming SUVs is that they want to flaunt their wealth. They want to tell people, show off that they are rich. So that's a completely morally unjustifiable act. If governments can't stop it, then ordinary people will have to.
Mr. Imam, I would like to come back to the critical questions of the legitimacy of sabotage. Traditional pacifists are arguing, with militant acts, you undermine your own goals and you delegitimize your cause. And you're basically entering a territory of the state, a state that is by far more equipped with police, but also with media infrastructure to erase you and the climate activists from the public conversation. Does that not convince you?
Well, sabotage is a tactic for wrecking, damaging, destroying property. And yes, if you engage in sabotage, you come up against the forces of the state.
You because do it's so a criminal act.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But so is civil disobedience. Any kind of activism that challenges the vested interests come up against the superior force of the state. Now, sabotage can clearly be conducted in such a way that you elude the forces of the state. So tire extinguishers, again, are a brilliant example, because you have now something like 8,000 or 9,000 SUVs disarmed, as they say, over the span of maybe half a year in 13 different countries in the global north without a single activist having been arrested. Because this is a type of sabotage that you do in the dark, and you make sure that you just evade any kind of forces of repression that might show up. Now, we don't know, perhaps another 2 or 10 or 100,000 SUVs deflated down the road, someone might be arrested, but it's clearly possible to conduct a great deal of sabotage without ending up nabbed. This is, of course, in distinction from the civil disobedience of the classical kind that you've seen, for instance, XR undertaking in the UK and elsewhere, where a part of the action is to get arrested. So they see it as a kind of a tactical virtue or goal in itself to end up in jail. And that, I think, we need to break with. But, I mean, I respect that as one kind of action, one kind of activism. We shouldn't necessarily stop that kind of activism, but we also need to explore forms of climate action where you actually just get away from the cops.
But people would still say you don't gain popular support with acts of sabotage. And wouldn't it be much more efficient to have activists, experts, intellectuals put more work into persuading people, into new techniques of persuasion, if you so want, that are not involving any sabotage acts?
Yeah, we need all of that. We need everything. And we've tried persuasion without civil disobedience or sabotage for decades. Decades, and look where we are now. Now, if we stay with the case of the tire extinguishers, I don't think it's correct that their campaigns are alienating ordinary people. I actually think it's the other way around, that the idea of deflating the SUVs of the rich has much more popular appeal than actions such as blocking highways where you target commuters indiscriminately and in general, and you go after, you know, workers on their way to their homes or their workplaces. But if you have tactical precision and target luxury consumptions from the rich, you have a much broader appeal to general people than in some of the other kinds of action that you
see. But do you have statistics backing up that claim, or is that just a subjective feeling that you have?
I don't have statistics, because this is, the tire extinguishers are a pretty new phenomenon. So we need, of course, scientific studies of the popular perception of this to make this claim. But it's based on the reactions that I see on social media. And when I talk to journalists, including a journalist from Wall Street Journal of all outlets the other week, that have precisely these perceptions of how these actions are perceived in the UK in particular.
Yeah, because I read about different reactions, not only from the owners and the ones who are like targeted, but also from the state institutions, also other people who are like experts. And there's extremism experts that warn of the radicalization of certain climate activists like Letzte Generation. And they even draw a parallel to the early days of the RAF. They're saying they have the absolute conviction. They claim that they know the truth. They want to force their will onto the majority. And that is quite concerning if you have people saying that about them, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we should necessarily trust extremism experts to make the best judgments of these things. But a radicalization of the climate movement is, I think, inevitable. And it's not the product of people's grandiose self-perception or the product of propaganda from myself or anyone else. It's the product of the state of affairs, where we have a climate on this planet breaking down, and nothing that governments have done so far has in any way reined in the perpetrators of this planetary crime. So, you know, people just need to look around them and see that our planet is on fire. And it happens every summer in a worse and worse way, with more disasters.
And still, we're seeing the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. And that is what drives people towards more radical options. And rightly so. But I don't think the RAF parallel is relevant, really, because no one here is arguing for the formation of urban guerrillas. And I don't know anyone in the climate movement, not even the most radicalized young people that I meet, who seriously consider taking up guns in any way whatsoever. And that is a crucial qualitative difference.
Okay, to sum this up, you're complaining about the destruction of the planet. And one of the answers is the destruction of certain products. And I'm wondering, how can destruction be constructive?
Yeah, because if you have machines that kill and destroy, then, of course, taking these machines down is a kind of defense, self-defense or other defense. It's a limitation of harm. And that is not, I mean, yeah, you know, the solution to the problem of excessive SUV sales is, of course, public transportation and other modes of transportation. And that's not what activists do when they deflate SUVs. But we need to remember that a real transition away from the fossil economy entails the early retirement, which literally means the destruction of an immense amount of capital and machinery that you just need to do away with, to discard. So the solution to the climate problem isn't exclusively constructive. So to put it differently, it doesn't matter how many solar panels or wind turbines we build if we don't also shut down the oil wells and the platforms and the pipelines. There's an entire planet of infrastructure here that needs to be taken offline. That's the destructive aspect of the transition. So we have to have both. We have to have destruction and construction for there to be a real shift away from fossil fuels. The problem is that the destruction that is needed isn't happening anywhere. You have an energy addition where you build solar panels and you build wind turbines, but on top of a fossil fuel infrastructure that keeps expanding. And that makes no change for the climate if that expansion continues. And that's the task of the climate movement, to disrupt that expansion.
One last question. The French philosopher Bruno Latour passed away this week, and he's known for his extensive work on how the separation between nature and culture enables climate denial. What have you personally learned from Latour?
Well, you shouldn't talk bad about the deceased, particularly not those who have just deceased. So may he rest in peace. But I have to admit that I haven't really been inspired by him. I think that there are profound problems in his philosophy. I wrote a book largely devoted to critique of his position on these issues. But that, I should say that, I mean, it's an internal academic philosophical quarrel or quibble that I don't think is massively important. But I think that if we really want to go down into it, I think that an analytical distinction between natural and social processes is key to an understanding of the climate problem or other ecological problems for that matter and what we can do about them. So, for instance, the fact that glaciers and ice sheets melt when you have temperatures higher than 0 degrees, that's a natural process, a natural fact that we as humans cannot do anything about. On the other hand, the power of fossil fuel companies is not a natural fact. It's an entirely social fact. And it's the interaction between these two kinds of facts or processes that create the climate problem. Now, what we humans can do something about is the social side of the equation, not the natural one. And it's precisely this distinction that makes it so urgent for us to do something about fossil capital. But again, these are matters of philosophical analysis that aren't perhaps extreme. Because what Latour and others would say is that, no, you can't make a distinction between these two. Nature and society aren't distinct categories. There is no such thing, even analytically, as a distinction between them. But this isn't massively important for people in general.
No, but thank you for these insights, and maybe we can discuss this in another interview. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.